What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports
Medicine Broadcast, episode 103, The Many Faces of an Ankle Sprain, with Dr. Kelly Blevins. Dr. Kelly Blevins is an orthopedic surgeon affiliated with Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute and an assistant professor at the Department of Orthopedics at the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston Medical School. We are again on the broadcast thanks to Memorial Hermann and Bob Marley allowing us to jump in on the 13th annual Sports Medicine Update, where we get to record the sessions, which will be the first part of what you hear, and then we'll get to interview the guest, which will be the second part of what you hear. So I start off interviewing Dr. Blevin and then Dr. Josh Yellen from the University of Houston Masters of Athletic Training Program jumps in and asks some more questions. Of course, we have Jasmine Dozal doing all the back end work there for us, doing a great job, and I'm so thankful that she was able to come and help out. And then get to meet a lot of the professionals, and because she wants to be an athletic trainer, so it was a great opportunity for her. If you want to contact us, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. So I know this is airing after we've already begun the CEU webinars, but again, on sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, there's a way to register and sign up for the CEU webinars. If you do not register for the CEU webinars, then you cannot get the CEUs. So you can watch it live on YouTube, you can download the podcast, but if you don't register, then you don't get the CEUs. As always, if there's something you want to hear about, somebody you want to talk to, then contact us in one of those ways. It's either on Twitter, on Facebook, on Google+, via email, or I think my phone number is even on there. So if there's somebody you want to talk to, somebody you want to hear from, a topic you want covered, or two people that you want to hear from on opposing sides of an issue, then let us know, and then I'll do my best to get that on there. So we got some pretty good ones lined up. But again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com to register for the CEU event. And again, thanks to Bob Marley and the Memorial Hermann Sports Medicine team for allowing us to come out and do this great event, and then all the other great speakers for giving up a few minutes of their time. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me to speak. We always love talking to folks when we can about things that we have a passion for, and I do several different things. I like to do joint replacements as a personal interest, but I also do a lot of foot and ankle surgery related to sports medicine, and so that's kind of an interest of mine. And so we're going to talk today, hopefully kind of talk about some different things with ankle sprains. There's some very generic stuff that I'm sure all you guys know, but hopefully we can talk about how this is in today, what we think about it. And talk about, you know, the way this is termed, the many faces of an ankle sprain, because often one of the biggest problems we have with these is identifying what type of sprain they are as far as the degree of severity and what they really mean. So our treatments are based on that understanding, and it makes it very difficult in acute settings to make the right decisions sometimes. I don't have any disclosures other than this, that I'm consulting with one of the joint companies that we work with, but it's not related to this topic. So just in general, let's talk about what we're going to look at. So let's talk about some of the anatomy, the actual mechanisms of how these injuries happen. We'll talk about how to assess them and the proper management options as far as triage and what to do acutely versus in a formal way after initial managing them. And then we'll look at some of the options of what's important as far as the recovery process and how the role that rehab plays. And that really tends to be the biggest factors and success of treatment injuries. And we'll talk about some indications on what to do for prevention. So from a background standpoint, ankle sprains are extremely common. About 2 million a year they occur. If you look at the databases, I mean, they're about a third of all sport injuries. And the biggest concern I have is this next line, about a third of all of those actually can be considered going into the category of a chronic injury. And that's a big issue. And so I think the initial treatment of these appropriately is a big deal. In college, we're looking at a 0.83 of 1,000 athlete exposures. So that's pretty common. ACLs is about 0.15. So it's nowhere near as common as an ankle sprain, as you can imagine. And in high school, it's actually a little lower. Look at ankle anatomy. It's basically divided up into kind of these three groups. And most of the injuries are involving the lateral ankle. And these structures are the lateral joint stabilizers here, these ligaments. And there's the medial joint stabilizers being the deltoid ligament and its two components. And then a little more superiorly, you have at the level of the ankle, creating a more of a structural integrity with the bony stabilizers being the interosseous ligament and those ligaments in that zone. So if you look at these, the most common injured area is this anterior tibial fibular ligament, and kind of right here in the front. And what's interesting about this ligament is it is extremely weak. It is really a component with the anterior capsule of the ankle. And so it really doesn't have, it has the distinct fibers that you can see on exam, but unfortunately, you know, it's just not very durable. And it's considered to be about a fifth of the load to failure strength of the deltoid ligament on the medial aspect, which is actually very strong. And the big thing, and the reason these are torn very easily, is because anything with even very minor inversion sprain or mechanism can actually cause an injury to it. And so your grade ones and early grade twos almost always involve to some degree an injury to this ligament. So it's tightest in plantar flexion. So you can imagine with the toes pointed and an inverted type mechanism, you can get an easy injury to this area in the capsule. And it also resists anterior talus translation, so the actual foot coming out from underneath the tibia. And about 85% of ankle sprains involve this ligament. Then we're talking about the calcaneal fibular ligament, which is here on the outside, kind of shown strangely here, but it goes deep to the peroneal tendons, which are running here. And it is a little stronger than the ATFL, but definitely not as strong as the deltoid. And it resists inversion and kind of the heel going in. And as you can imagine, with your foot actually in more dorsiflexion or ankle coming up, the toes coming up, it actually puts tension on this. So as the foot comes up, the heel drops down, and it actually puts more tension on this. So very commonly, you can have a combination of injuries here, the ATFL and the CFL. Much more dramatic mechanism. It has to have multiple levels of rotation as well. And because it spans the subtalar joint here between the talus and the calcaneus, it actually provides a stabilizer to that joint as well. So it has kind of multiple functions. The posterior tibiofibular ligament is resists dorsiflexion as well, and it provides stability for posterior translation. We often see this injured kind of as things wrap around, if the mechanism continues with that type of mechanism. The deltoid ligament medially is made of a constellation of different ligaments in this complex. And what it does is it fans out, it provides incredible stability and resistance to lateral translation of the talus. So as a tethering type mechanism, it prevents that. And it also resists external rotation. And that's a big deal because very commonly, injuries we see at the level of the syndesmosis and some of these more severe injuries, we're concerned about it. The deltoid is often involved. And there's also one way that we can assess how bad the syndesmosis injury is of the ankle is based on whether the deltoid is involved or not. And then here in the syndesmosis, which is really here, you know, consider a portion of the injury to this is a sprain, and the partial tear would be, you know, some degree of a high ankle sprain. And this is also very different than a standard ankle sprain because of the way it's treated and examination as well as a result of treatment. And you get these different components of it contributing to actually the whole strength of the complex. And with the interosseous membrane, actually it runs between the fibula and the tibia, extending up towards the knee. There's other factors that come into play and provide stability to the ankle. And these are very important, and we'll talk about this more in the rehab aspect, but the peroneal tendons, as they course across the ankle laterally, are very important for dynamic stabilization. We call these the secondary stabilizers. So very commonly, if someone has an injury to their ligaments, or even the chronic setting, has a deficiency there, the peroneal tendons become very important to stabilizing the ankle, providing support to be active. Proprioception, balance, muscular strength, all these things are definitely contribute to stability. So people who have deficiencies in these areas or don't regain them from a rehab standpoint at more at risk for injury in the future. So look at the different injury classifications. These are kind of standard for all the ligament injuries we talk about, and they go in a different. So we have grade one, which is mild. Some of the fibers are torn, but in general, you'd say that the tissue is in continuity. Otherwise, grade two injury is much more involved as far as the tear. And sometimes on exam, you definitely demonstrate some instability or this laxity. And then the third one being a grade three level injury, which involves complete disruption of the ligament itself. And that can be a significant injury. So one of the things that really is important is to try to figure out, you know, what do you do when you see somebody that has this injury? So important things to know. Obviously, if you see the accident happen or you see the athlete get injured, it's much easier to predict what's involved. But knowing what the mechanism is and the history and how these things happen can be helpful. Knowing the foot position, because you know, with this being a weight-bearing area, pretty much everything that happens to it is based on the foot position. So if your foot's planted and the body rotates one way or the other, that can give you the same injury as the foot being caught and twisted the opposite way. So it's important to know whether the vector force is basically an external rotation or an internal rotation, because that'll classify basically the type of areas that are ligaments that are injured. And then knowing whether the athlete has a previous injury or sprain. So you know, the highest rate of injury is greatest with re-injury. In folks who are inadequately rehabbed or just have had a recent injury and really aren't recovered. So initial assessment, like I said, knowing that the way these things happen, and the on-field exam, and this is important because you know, we want to get some good information as we can. And so obviously looking at immediate swelling, looking at people who are developing different areas of bruising, is important to understand and visualize that. Often you don't know that initially, but you can gain that in the next few hours sometimes looking at them again. Actually palpating the bone, knowing is this truly a fracture or is it just a sprain? Sometimes it's difficult to tell because there's still tender over the bone. But you usually have a pretty good feel looking for any extra motion or things that are just kind of abnormal. And then doing some instability testing. You know, there's different tests that are described. There's the anterior drawer test. This ankle, and we'll do that in a little bit. There's a squeeze test where we look at trying to assess the syndesmosis there to understand that injury pattern. And then there's some other different types of things you can do with external rotation testing that sometimes help us make decisions on the degree of involvement. And then, you know, knowing, can this patient bear weight? Is that something that's easy for them to do, or is it very difficult? Does it start out that way and then develop, or they can do it in 5 minutes later? Those are the important things to know about trying to judge the severity. And the hardest thing about this whole process is knowing how to grade these early minutes or at least on the initial evaluation. It's very difficult. I've seen athletes, we think, you know, or you think by the way they act in an exam, that they really have a horrible injury. You know, 10 minutes later, they feel fine. So it's really important to do an appropriate assessment and reassessment to know where we are. As far as immediate care, you know, things that we ought to do is reassess these athletes, you know, as you can, in different intervals, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Find out, are things changing, evolving? Can they bear weight now and couldn't 10 minutes ago? Do things help? Taping, you know, bracing, functional bracing, are these things helpful to make these folks feel confident and comfortable and be able to continue to participate? And then knowing whether they can or not. So obviously, if you've got an athlete who can't participate and is injured, we know that. You know, it's worth shutting that down and go ahead and you know, doing all the typical standard things of ice and protection, splinting, or whatever's necessary to then plan for a formal evaluation some other date. And typically, I do that, you know, sometimes several days later, only because you truly get a reassessment. It's not kind of the same exam again. I have patients all the time who make an appointment to come in and they thought, oh my gosh, I've just ruined my ankle. And 3 days later they say, I'm embarrassed to be here, it doesn't even hurt. So it can really change and be a different presentation based on when you see these folks. So in formal assessment, there's some different things we do. Most of it's a repeat examination of what was previously done a lot of times, but knowing kind of how things evolve and knowing what seems to be the pertinent issues at the time of the reassessment. So has their weight bearing status changed? Are they able to bear weight now, or could they initially and now they can't? Those are things that are important to know. And they can usually give you some feedback on what they've tried, what's been effective, what to do. A lot of these folks we like to have, obviously, you know, splinted and protected until we can get that formal assessment and you can get x-rays sometimes because it's helpful to know what we're dealing with. So standard things, the palpation, you know, looking for areas of tenderness. Are they tender right over these specific ligaments we were looking at? And those are the things that you need to know because it helps you devise a plan. You use a special testing, as I'll show in a minute, that helps you to kind of decide what's going on. So our typical test that we do up here on the right top corner, and that's doing an intra-dura test. And that's done by stabilizing the tibia, you know, basically anterior translation of the heel and the foot relative to that, with the foot in slight plantar flexion because the talus being wider anteriorly than posteriorly. What happens is if you bring the foot up in full dorsiflexion and you try this exam, I mean, it's going to feel fairly stable most of the time because they're actually getting the bony filling of that space. If you decide to slight plantar flexion, you can actually put the anterior ligament on maximum stretch, you know, as far as resistance, and see does it truly translate. And these are, you know, kind of touchy feeling things. I mean, you're really looking at you know, things that you feel like are obvious. Most folks on examination initially, you can't even do these things. It's just too uncomfortable. So you get a feeling that they're much more injured than they are, and you just later they look great. They don't have any near the issues. And while I'm down here, I have shown a squeeze test. And this test, we're looking at the distal portion, or assessing the distal portion of the distal tibiofibular articulation of the ankle. And by squeezing higher up on the tibia and the fibula, you can get a feel of the pain that they have in the anterior ankle. And so that gives you a much better idea of, if there's pain in that area, not where you're squeezing, but distally from that, is there truly an injury to that ligament because of the translation of the force? And look at imaging. Imaging, you know, we talk about always the discussion of should we x-ray, should we not, how do we know? I find that most of the time we do this anyway, even if we think for sure it's probably a sprain. It helps us to devise a plan and definitely, obviously, you know, not miss the things you'd want to know about, if these patients have a fracture or not. But that also gives you some feedback on what the expectations are. So typical standard x-rays, you know, three views of the ankle are helpful, and we'll go through that second what you look for. But x-rays of the knees is also important if you think they may have an injury to their syndesmosis, because very commonly these folks will have enough of a trauma that causes what's called known as a meson knee fracture. And that is a syndesmotic injury at the ankle, that the energy goes up the syndesmosis and the interosseous membrane and then exit out the proximal fibula near the knee. And we see patients all the time that say, oh, I know you had a bad mechanism. The ER says, oh, you just sprained your ankle. And they come in and they say, well, you know, actually, well, the side of my knee hurts some too. And realize they actually have a significant injury pattern. It's a very unstable pattern in regard to the ankle. And then look at the different stress views. There's some different ways to do this. Some of you can manually get stress views, some of them gravity. These are usually more helpful in chronic injuries, but you can do them in acute phase. And then sometimes weight bearing films are helpful. You can definitely see some difference in comparing the subtleties of the spacing on the weight bearing film of an ankle versus non-weight bearing. So things you look for. So if we're looking at the plain anterior x-ray of an ankle, we look at several issues here. So we want to look at the tibiofibular overlap, and that should be about at least six millimeters, okay? So that's this overlap of the fibula and the tibia. And then there's the clear space here between the tibia and the fibula, and that should be fairly small. It should be greater than 5. And then the medial clear space over here, assessing really the stability of the deltoid ligament as well as the syndesmosis. Because you can imagine, if you've got enough force to cause an injury here, and this is disrupted, the talus, as well as the deltoid ligament, the talus will translate laterally, so that's important. Another thing we check here is always looking to see if the medial clear space is fairly symmetrical and equidistant in the same way to the superior clear space. And these should usually be within 1 millimeter of each other if you measure this distance and this distance for things to be intact. So getting stress views, you know, when you look at that sum, there's not a whole lot of good data that shows that it's really effective. You can do it with gravity, but this is actually going to make you do the leg kind of hanging down. I haven't found this particularly helpful in this setting. There's also looking at, you know, tailored tilt and some different things on exam that can help, but mostly in the chronic setting. In weight-bearing film, so often what you'll see is something like this. Well, they look pretty normal on regular film, but when you get a weight-bearing film, this opens up. As well as they get some lateral translation of the talus there. And so that indicates a more significant injury than maybe initially thought. Because they're all tender, and then you have to look at other things. So other ways to image, folks. Definitely MRIs are very helpful. You can see all the anatomy. You can see the local tendons coursing through there. You can see the joint. You can assess osteochondral injuries, injuries to the bone and the cartilage within the ankle joint. Very commonly, you know, we don't do this, and just for it doesn't change our management on most single ankle sprains. If you're really concerned about some of those other issues of the actual joint injury, they can be very helpful. Ultrasound is gaining popularity in assessing some of these. I'm not so sure how helpful it is. I mean, you most definitely can in the office. Take an ultrasound machine and look at the ligaments to see if they're disrupted and injured, but most of the time you know that on exam anyway. So I don't find it helpful to make my decisions on how to treat folks. And CT scan is not as common, typically more for bone injuries or something you're trying to look at specifically. Here's a couple of MRI images. This is looking at the deltoid ligament. There's a couple different views. So here's the coronal plane, here's the medial malleolus here. Look at the deltoid ligament, and normally you'd see a nice, you know, significant black structure here, and all this is whitened and full of swelling, so you really can identify that's an injury there. But literally, once again, just a sprain where it's not completely disrupted but involved. Same thing here, you see the significant swelling beneath. This is the running of the posterior tibial tendon coming down the medial aspect of the ankle. And looking here, here's an injury to the and they're kind of a high ankle sprain, the anterior tibiofibular ligament that spans right here across from the fibula to the tibia. That's a significant, you see the weightiness to it and actually all the swelling. And then here, showing actually the injury that even, you know, translates up the interosseous ligament here into the membrane. So that's a pretty significant injury that's in the osseous there. And actually, MRI is probably the most helpful tool on this if you really think it's on exam how significant the injury is. So senior management, you know, from our academy, we have our senior stuff that probably everyone knows. I mean, rest, ice, compression, elevation, all these things as initial measurement management options are actually very helpful. You know, and then we really try to get people moving on as quickly as possible to the next phase of functional management, which would include starting to do some exercises and some rehabilitation. Immobilization is important. I think we discuss all the time about what are the different options for that. I am pretty aggressive with immobilizing folks if I really think the severity of the injury warrants it. And I'll talk about that in a minute, because what we found is most of the severe injuries, if treated inappropriately from the beginning, actually end up with a bad result. And that's simply, you know, not kind of taking your lumps early and actually get better faster with more immobilization. There is a role for injections, but very limited. It's kind of interesting, we're starting to look at that in different studies. Surgery, not many indications, and the physical therapy is critical. So things to do. So the couple studies here, interesting enough, recently looking at some of these things. Glucosteroids really have not been studied. No one has really done this. We have done this before in some different level athletes. Acute injection, injection for acute injuries. It can make things feel better. It doesn't seem to have any good data to support it, so it's not a routine thing that we recommend. And then use of hyaluronic acid, which is basically Symdisk or some of these products you may have heard of, the rooster comb type injections, have been done actually for their anti-inflammatory prospect. So they have a hyaluronic acid found in the healthy joint fluid. It actually has an anti-inflammatory property. And this study, what they did is they took acute ankle sprain, grade 1 and 2, and actually just peppered the anterior tibial fibular ligament with these different products, the hyaluronic acid. And interesting enough, these folks got better faster than those who did not have that management. And it's interesting, is that something we can do in everyone? Obviously not. It's cost prohibitive, but definitely at a certain level of athletes, that may be something worth encouraging. Get people back to play. Immobilization, different ways to look at this. Looking at all the reviews, or at least this review that is kind of a meta-analysis of a bunch of different studies, show that most of them favor functional treatment. And that involves allowing people to be late during and active with some sort of protection. So not just simply putting them completely immobilized all the time for several weeks, but getting that process to that level as quickly as possible to get a good result. It seems to be more helpful. What I see a lot of is folks coming in with no management at all. So no direction, no plan. I injured my ankle a month ago, and it just still looks awful. It's still horribly swollen, they're painful, they can barely walk, and they thought, oh, it's not that bad, I'll get over this. And basically they said, no direction. And that's what we've seen critical to prevent these folks from going on to chronic
issues.
So functional bracing, this is what we call this. So here's different examples of it. Obviously that the air cast stirrup brace, here being an active ankle, here in the middle, and then an ASO type stuff. Those are very common ones that we use all the time. And the key is to get people to this phase, because you can start doing some therapies and exercises that definitely get them better. So in a couple other studies, this is an interesting study because they looked at severe ankle sprains. And usually we know these are severe, at least we categorize these, mostly not so much as how we can grade them, but based on their symptoms. If you feel like severe bruising, severe swelling, I can tell you, I don't care what level of involved injury they have as far as the ligaments and how you can grade it. If those are the findings, they definitely benefit from early mobilization. And that means something like splaining or even casting. And I won't hesitate when someone not having severe enough injury, I think they have to start doing these things early, because if you do this for the first 10 days or so, these people get over this phase, move on, and actually can move on to the functional bracing and exercises, and it really does help them rather than smolder on. And if they look at this study, interesting enough, those with severe injuries who had a cast initially did better at 3 months as far as symptom resolution than those who are functional braced or not placed in anything. So surgery, from our foot and ankle society, there is really and very much a position paper and statement that there's no evidence to support acute surgical management for typical ankle sprains. I think there may be a role for it in some of our elite athletes, and that is still questionable. I think we have not seen that to be effective and particularly helpful. And that's kind of their statement on that. Other areas are a little more controversial as far as what you do with these, and that involves injuries with syndesmosis. Just the sprain of the syndesmosis where you have some high ankle sprain with no true diastasis of the ankle joint or widening or related fractures like in the Mason fracture, there's really no indication for those either. However, their treatment is different in the sense that these people have difficulty bearing weight early on. And that's one of the good tests, because of the difference in where the mechanism is with more of an external rotation injury. They definitely get some different issues, because you can imagine, as you bear weight on your foot, the tibia and the fibula tend to spread apart. If those ligaments that help maintain that conformity are involved, it's very painful. So that's one of the good tests of knowing, in palpation, how high does it go up above the ankle at the level of the syndesmosis to know, are these folks, how bad is the injury? How long do we have to wait to rehab these folks, or how long does it take them to get better? And definitely the recovery on a high ankle sprain is very different and a little bit longer. Those who have a true diastasis and widening, that's a surgical indication. This is a disruption of their normal anatomy that needs to be restored for stability and long-term issues. And we do that a couple different ways. Now routinely, years ago, for years we've done screw fixation, maintaining the alignment of the two, the fibula and the tibia at the ankle. And other times we're doing more of a generically known as endovitin or a tightrope technique, which is basically placing a non-absorbable suture through a tunnel to recreate the stability of those ligaments. There's an example of it. As you can see here, it's definitely a medial clear space widening here, so indicating disruption there. So typically the energy comes in the ankle, the extra rotation, foot and the tail is being translated laterally relative to the tibia. So your disruption of the deltoid ligament, energy goes through the ankle and then up the syndesmosis. And we talked about, there should be an overlap of at least 1 millimeter in all views of the tibia and the fibula here. And you see there's definitely a diastasis there. So this injury happens when the ligament's disrupted here at the syndesmosis and then translated up the interosseous membrane there, very commonly comes out approximately brachial fibula. And this is kind of a standard treatment, at least for years we've done this. And this is very effective. And what you're trying to restore is this articulation here and alignment, restoring the talar position underneath the tibia. The ankle is a very congruent joint. It does not have a lot of space. And so the way it works by the conformity is it's supposed to have that kind of stability. It's very difficult to walk on sloppy ankles. And so it's really important to restore that. The issue we come up with as far as what do you do with this, and the idea that endovitin has become popular in some of the hands, is this is fairly rigid. There's supposed to be about 2 or 3 millimeters of translation every time you take a step relative from your tibia to your fibula. This prevents that. That does not allow for that motion. However, typically we remove these as that ligament heals. And so typically that's between 12 to 16 weeks after surgery. I still do this routinely because I know what it gives me. The problem with the endovitin is there's some issues with how well do you really recreate as far as the stability. I can always remove these and try to prevent them from breaking. The problem with endovitin too is, does it maintain that over time? Does it allow for the proper healing to get them through this? Both are fun to do, but it's necessary. Standard ankle sprains, though, absolutely not. Here's a depiction of the endovitin. So basically kind of do this, and very commonly we're doing this now with fractures. So fracture comes through, it breaks the fibula, but also disrupts the distal syndesmosis. We know that after we fix this is a problem. So typically we'll use this technique of channeling this through the bone to provide that stability that allows for the natural motion. So really the whole interest in this was basically to try to recreate that stability, allowing for some of the motion without having to remove the hardware. In reality, what's happened is a lot of these have skin irritation, both medially as well as where it's set up over here, and you have to remove them anyway. So it really doesn't solve that problem. It's not as effective as we initially thought it would be. So recovery, this is really dependent on the amount of injury and how you can progress people through the process. So the whole idea is to get people as quickly as possible to a functional pattern of recovery, meaning that you can get them to walking, ambulating reasonably, and starting to do some of the exercises that get them better. And definitely this idea of accelerated rehab does work for this. The key is knowing, when can you advance people? And I kind of, this is a general rule of, there's definite adjustments to be made every 2 weeks in the management option for these kind of ankle injuries. So I want to know if I see someone 3 days after their injury and they look capable of walking and functional brace, I get them doing that and I actually probably send them straight to start therapy. And the reason being, if you can start working on your balance, proprioception, weight-bearing activities that help gain that, it actually helps a lot and people recover much faster. However, the other side of that, if you have a severe ankle sprain, you don't just send them to start doing therapy and start walking on them. No, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I do have some folks I put in boots, being that they can then be ambulatory because their ankle motion is protected, and it frees up their arms. And it's definitely for our student athletes, it's a big deal, because otherwise they're stuck on crutches with a functional brace they can't even use because they're having these crutches. So, you just gotta figure out where people are and what's the next move. But every 2 weeks there's definitely something different to do these folks, or at least to reassess where they are, to know how to get them to the functional status to start working on things. With the rehab process, it really is working on balance, proprioception, all these things that are typical. And a huge deal, you know, what we found is those who don't have this kind of neuromuscular retraining are much higher risk for re-injury. And that is a very big deal. In the first year, folks who, there's the highest risk. So if you don't have the proper retraining and getting things back on track, it really makes these folks at high risk for an initial injury. So grade 1 and 2, very commonly, you can do that pretty early. There's lots of studies showing that accelerated PT is very helpful. And home programs are actually very effective. There have been many studies looking at giving folks an appropriately devised home program on a DVD and have them complete it and make sure that they really do complete it. Most people, if they feel better, kind of stop doing things. The whole key is to complete this, and it does take about 8 to 10 weeks to really get that all back. And here, looking at the stuff in this particular study, they actually had an 11% reduction in the re-injury rate, which is really our goal. You know, we don't want these to become chronic injuries, and it's fun surgery to perform, but rarely do I have people who treat people correctly from the beginning, they get better. So the always question about return to play. You know, with lesser grade injuries, obviously, some people are very surprised in a couple weeks they feel pretty good. Very commonly, taping, functional bracing for these folks early on with athletics works fine. And by this time, they're even ready to return to play. They're not even using their bracing necessarily for regular ambulation and doing exercises and kind of getting to a functional program. Grade 2, it's a little more involved. These go into more of this category I was describing when I see these folks really need maintenance care as far as marching it out. We're kind of seeing them every 2 weeks to devise something different. And grade 3 sprains are much more involved, have some true instability. You got to protect these folks early because they just get in trouble. These are the ones that are at risk for really developing chronic problems and needing reconstruction surgery to restore their stability. So prevention, there's not any good data that really shows a benefit. Primary prevention, meaning we do this on everyone. So let's say we bring every athlete in and say, you're playing soccer, we're going to put you all in braces. However, there are a couple studies that are pretty effective, shown it to be effective, there's just not enough of them. And in particular athletic activities, I think there is a role for it. And this is a particular volleyball study that actually gains a lot of talk because it's pretty dramatic how much this has been reduced. You look at this, over this time frame, the 7 years they had these folks at University of Pennsylvania using ankle braces, kind of an active ankle brace, and all of their athletes, and their rate of injury or athlete exposures was minimal in comparison. I mean, it's much better than the standard going to college. So I think there's some credence to it based on the athletic activity. As far as the risk of injury, it can be helpful. We have seen a lot of these folks have benefited from some degree of kind of preseason planning and training as far as proprioception and balance exercises. But that goes for any athletic endeavor. I think we've learned that those things can be very helpful to prevent injuries. But bracing itself has a limited issue. So prevention secondarily, secondary prevention is kind of our key. We're trying to prevent re-injury, and use of the functional bracing and taping can be very effective. Some of the things we talk about bracing, what does it provide? In reality, a lot of it is a tactile feedback system. When your proprioception, your balance, and your kind of recognition of foot position and body position is not that great from an injury. In the early phases, taping and bracing give you some of that tactile feedback to know, hey, I've just planted my foot, I'm twisting, this is bad, you reposition because I feel the tape tighten. There's some benefit to that. The problems with taping we always have is it tends to loosen up after a certain amount of time, so it provides it doesn't provide it from a full event potentially, but definitely is a good idea. And same thing with bracing, there's some feedback on that. The key is this absolute relative risk reduction, which we've seen, which is pretty significant. This is how we're trying to prevent these folks from developing chronic injuries, because I was describing that first year after having a significant ankle injury, you're more likely to develop a recurrent injury. And those who have recurrent injuries develop the instability long term. So the neuromuscular training and control is really important to develop. strengthen the muscles, the perineals especially, is what we work on. And then reestablishing that motor neuron reflex that we want to provide the feedback on positioning. And as you know, I was describing, it really does take a good 8 to 10 weeks of working on this to be effective. And you get some dropouts, some folks when they feel better, but I'm telling you, you get them completed, it makes a big difference. Question?
Five.
Oh, five. Sorry. Start to see if it's my bad. All right, so in summary, ankle sprains are very common, but are very different and very difficult to assess in the early acute phase. The anterodactyl triple ligament is most commonly injured. Initial assessment can be difficult, as I was describing. Syndesmosis injuries are definitely a big deal. We worry about those. It's important to know the difference in those. Most of those can be decided based on exam and location of tenderness and pain. And then obviously some of these need to be evaluated for additional studies as far as imaging to know how involved it is, to understand and recovery and when to get these people, or to try to move these people on to their functional recovery and rehab status. Basically, with the spear injuries, I think it's a big deal to immobilize these folks in the early phase. 10 to 14 days of being in a splint or a cast really does let them calm down and cool off. And then you can be ready for that next phase. And definitely I've seen folks who, if you let them kind of smolder and continue to walk on their functional brace from the very beginning of the course of your injury, it's don't do well. They smolder on and on and on and really can't progress to where they want to be. So if they get on early, sometimes they get to their own faster. We see the bracing is a very helpful tool in the early phase of recovery and preventing re-injury. And then restoring your proprioception and balance with the strengthening of the ability key to maintain your recovery and also preventing re-injury. All right. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah, and it's very difficult to know. I think most of those, at least when we see them, other than it's literally on the field exam, which is hard. Everyone is at fault for not identifying the injury correctly in that phase. I am too. So it really helps to have a repeat exam taken several days later. So usually in that phase, you can identify. You see how the ecchymosis has really come in. You get a much better idea of where they are. So. And the severe injury, mostly it's symptoms. I mean, if you have someone who is severely painful, can't bear weight, very swollen, all those things, you can say, well, this is not working. I think it's just better to protect them, get them started. And there's really no benefit to marching them on quickly. I mean, we talk about how it's a big deal to get people. If they're not in that phase, it doesn't matter. You can beat up for the next 3 weeks, they're going to be miserable, not do well. So it's kind of a field thing of when they're ready for that. But all you reason, some folks, they've got a bad injury that in 2 weeks I'm not ready for them to move on from a casting routine. I'll put them here in a walking boot for protection that's kind of similar to a walking cast, or even put them in a cast. I've heard some folks that just knowing that they're not ready for the next phase, and that's the important step, is kind of getting to that functional activity. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so the question was, at what point would I ever do surgery on ankle sprain? Almost never.
Is this?
Really, there's no indication. I've had a few kids in the last few years who had bad enough injuries from fractures, say, on our abdominal ligaments that we've been fixing in that. I was interested in seeing how the other injuries that they had, having a deltoid injury, on the medial side, and decided, okay, I'm planning to fix this kid, also side. And you fix the lymphoma, and they're so stable and almost normal, you couldn't make the justification for the kid, most kids. I mean, you can open up and look at it and say, hey, yes, there it is. They just do extremely well in surgical management. And even some studies shown those who have surgery, which you could say maybe these are more severe injuries. Long term, a lot of those folks develop arthritis. It's the study showed that. So the question is, well, are they the more severe injuries that would have gotten arthritis anyway? And therefore, is that a confounding factor? Or is it related to having extra points of surgery? And so we always worry about that in the sense of causing more harm. It is difficult to counsel patients to think, okay, you're going to do fine. I know this is going to be surgery. Surgery is not always the answer, but often that's what I would say. It does take a while to get over some of these injuries that are severe. I mean, up to a year in some folks. It's just kind of important to kind of guide folks what direction to go. That it's not just cutting dry some of the injuries that we see.
Blevins, and he's going to tell you a little bit about himself in just a second. But really good conversation that we had over there while Josh was still interviewing Dr. Kepinger was about ankle sprains, ankle bracing, and that kind of thing. And we'll talk about that here in just a minute. But Dr. Blevins, welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'm saying your name correctly, right?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about who you are and your practice.
Yeah, no, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I'm with the UT Physicians. My home and basically where I practice is in the Woodlands at the Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. And you know, do standard stuff for orthopedic injuries and focus on sports medicine. Personal interest in foot and ankle surgery. I've been fellowship in that, and that's kind of what we do.
All right, so you say a personal interest. Is that just because that's something that you had, or is that just
So specifically for our group, you know, we got several guys who do standard sports medicine issues as far as knees and shoulders, and I do mostly low extremity knees, and then a lot of the foot and ankle that they don't do. So
gotcha. Okay, just to make sure I understand the word.
Yeah, sure.
All right, so I know we were talking over there, and since they couldn't hear it, I'm gonna go ahead and say it again. Is one of the things that I'll often do, since we have extra walking boots, is after a kid sprains an ankle, you know, even if it's not really bad, I'll put them in that walking boot for about, you know, 2 or 3 days, that kind of thing, and let them calm down, and that way they're not so inflamed, they're not trying to walk on it or limp on it, and then reevaluate and begin exercises, even we'll begin exercises the next day, range of motion exercises. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, as you were kind of describing to me, I was talking about how it really is a good idea, because what I try to do with folks, at least when we can get that initial assessment, as we were discussing in the talk, I mean, it's very difficult in the acute setting to get the right understanding of how to categorize some of these injuries. So sometimes they all seem severe, or they seem minor, and then they turn out to be more severe. That you kind of want to be protective early on. And I think what I found is if you can get folks to a ambulatory status, which the boot would provide, rather than having a lot of motion with some of these ankle injuries, it's very helpful. So, you know, if you put them into a functional, you know, lace-up brace or something like a stirrup brace, there's really not that protective immobilization that allows them to be weight-bearing. So they may try it, and they're still very painful. They're still using crutches. They're really not mobile. And so if you can still protect them as in, like, truly immobilizing them and then reassessing them early, I think it's kind of the key. Because what we find often is within 2 days, I mean, some of these folks look so much better that you're very surprised that it seems so severe to start with.
Correct.
And often the other way around, you get the reassessment process going, you realize, wow, this is a much more severe injury than we initially thought. So it gives you an opportunity to both manage, support, move along, and then make a decision later about what's the right thing in that early phase.
Very cool. And then the other thing I was telling you, we were just talking about bracing with the immobilization. So taping, one of the things I got from, again, I mentioned his name because I got it from a guy on Twitter, is S. Lorio, but I don't even know his name because that's what it says on, do you use Twitter?
Not much, but yes, so.
All right, so anyways, so that's what his name is. And what he does is anybody that wants to get taped, they have to do proprioceptive exercises.
Right.
So like TheraBand exercises, balancing exercises, I think single leg squats, those kind of things to help strengthen the proprioception of the ankle before taping. And so what are your thoughts there on that?
Well, yes, I think most definitely. I think if that's the carrot that you dangle to get some of these folks to do the appropriate you know, exercises and the proprioceptive training, that really does help prevent these type of injuries. It's worth it. You know, taping we know as a thing that we can do for folks. It can be helpful for some of the feedback it provides. Very often though, it loosens and then it's no longer doing what it was initially designed to do after so many minutes of activity. But still, I think getting folks to do the proper preventative training is probably helpful. And that's been shown to be very effective if you can do it.
All right, so jumping around a little bit, in your talk, you were talking about diastasis, meaning a high ankle sprain. I don't actually know what that word means.
Yeah, so diastasis means widening. So if at the distal articulation between the fibula and the tibia, if where that normally that ligament crosses and provides that stability at that level, with that being disrupted, it's widening.
Okay.
We term that diastasis. And so that's an important finding on x-ray, because if that's true, you know that not only is the ligament injured, it's completely disrupted and can cause a lot of instability. And those folks, because that is pretty much the corner of the ceiling of your ankle joint,
right?
It's really important to maintain that configuration. So when that's disrupted, that's more of a surgical management to restore that.
Right, so we actually had two girls this year, both of them in volleyball, have a high ankle sprain, and the doctor, orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Crumby, I was there on the Saturday injury clinic, and he recommended surgery for one of them, but she was living with a friend, no insurance, that kind of thing, ended up not having it, and then came back to play, sporadically, just because she's she would play and then it would be hurting.
Right.
So what do you think of the long term? How's that girl going to fare? I know you didn't see it, so
right.
You can't,
Well, sure. I think, the issue with the high ankle sprains is how much of an injury is it? And sometimes it's difficult to gauge. I think we do see some of those folks do extremely well still. Their treatment is a little more prolonged as far as recovery. But still can do well. And I think it's a judgment call, and it's a little controversial on, which ones are bad enough to treat surgically and to restore that stability. I think if you truly have widening that you can identify on either plain radiographs or staining x-rays at least, some of those folks definitely can benefit from it. Because every step they're taking, there's that splaying effect of the two bones coming apart, and that's not natural or normal for normal people. So in essence, some of those folks, even though you'd say, well, who really needs to be fixed? Well, those if you fix, may recover much quicker. So that's definitely a judgment call, but definitely still be in the game.
Yeah, because he was saying that she's going to have chronic ankle instability or chronic.
That's right, and that's what you worry about. And those are the ones that I said, it's a feel of who really needs it. And some of them do not do well from that standpoint if they have chronic ankle issues. And in my talk also, I was commenting on how nearly a third of all chronic issues as far as sports injuries go are the ankle. I mean, it's pretty significant that if we don't, identify these things correctly and have the proper treatments in place, they have chronic issues that are difficult to manage.
Yeah, I've been learning more and more. I mean, I've been doing this podcast for, about 3 years now, and it's amazing how much I learn just from talking to people, because sitting in the lectures is one thing, but then I get to ask you questions,
sure.
You get to explain
very
it to
specifically,
me.
Sure.
And if I don't understand it, then I say, hold up, diastasis, I didn't know what that was, widening, well, that's easy, I got it now. Now the whole slide makes sense.
Right,
so,
sure.
Now, you also mentioned the screws breaking off. How often, then, when you're fixing the, what is it?
Yeah, so the syndesmosis there.
Yeah.
So normally what we do, if you have a bad enough widening in the diastasis there, it usually requires two to get some true control through that zone. And so we usually put those several centimeters apart. Because one, we'll just have kind of a toggle windshield wiper effect that we don't really want. So usually do two. And usually in those cases, actually, the chance of it breaking are not very good because there's enough kind of bridging support for each one. It can happen. So if you let these folks bear weight and become more active with that rigid construct there, when there's supposed to be some motion translation between these two bones, it's at high risk for breakage, just because it's so rigid. And so typically we remove them. So when we get people far enough along that we think their recovery is good and the ligaments are healed, we'll actually plan to remove them, and then obviously, don't worry about the breakage beyond that. So the key is getting to it early enough and knowing that, yes, it requires an initial surgery, but a pretty minor thing. And most of them, it's an improvement, because now they've gained that motion back that was fairly fixed, and they're happy with that in that phase.
You said that movement is normally 12 to 16 years? Is that what I heard?
Yeah, so typically, ligaments take a little bit longer to get in down sometimes. So we're expecting ligaments to heal easily within that 12-week period. So if you can go ahead and plan on removing them when you know they're healed, That's kind of the move.
Right. Will you jump in here? Or you...
No.
Okay.
If you want me to.
Sure.
I can.
Sure you sure.
Hey, what up?
Sure. You know Dr. Josh Yellen?
Hi.
Josh, how are you?
Hi. Josh Yellen.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, I'm jumping at the last minute here.
He was talking about ankle sprains, all the many different ones. And we were talking about high ankle sprains.
And the syndesmotic joint, that anterior tibial fibular ligament, really always really hard to heal and to treat.
No question. I said just the difficulties with knowing who's got the bad enough injury to fix and those issues are difficult.
Yeah, so can you elaborate just from my own knowledge, right? And as an athletic trainer, we have a high ankle sprain, that syndesmotic joint, the anterior tib fib, and it's usually either that forced dorsiflexion or that forced plantar flexion or whatever it is. And so from a surgical standpoint, when do I refer?
Well, usually the decision maker is understanding the mechanism usually and how severe it is, because that forced external rotation or forced dorsiflexion is what gets you a syndesmosis injury. So using those instances, almost on exam or that reassessment time we were talking about several days after the initial injury, how severe some of these are and can bear weight, these people are not doing well.
And, it's the Cleaver test, the Cliver test that
right.
you use, right?
Sure. So, doing some of these squeeze tests and even just on palpation up the syndesmosis and the interosseous membrane, knowing how high the level of the energy goes is helpful. Mm-hmm. And then standing plane films are very helpful just to see, is there truly a widening of the syndesmosis? Is there gapping on the medial aspect of the talus where you can indicate that the deltoid's been disrupted or injured as well?
And what would you see if I take a plane film, and I'm assuming it would be an anterior posterior or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on a simple film, I would see that the black hole of gapping.
Sometimes on just a plain standard film, you would, non-weight bearing. However, sometimes you can appreciate that nuance by getting a standard film and then a standing AP film. Because you can really demonstrate, wow, look how the talus translates laterally, that you get that external rotation force that's created just by weight bearing.
And that's indicative of, obviously, that deltoid ligament is...
That's right. So, and you have the deltoid, it's interesting enough, be having the superficial and the deep fibers, there'll be times some of them are disrupted and some are completely intact depending on the foot position.
Right.
So you can be fooled on exam whether they're all intact. Rarely are they all gone, unless it's just severe, and that's usually very obvious. And so what happens is you will see the translation, but some tethering, but it definitely is a gapping.
Mm-hmm.
And you will appreciate that on plain x-ray sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And those just really indicate the severity of it. So then you're looking at overall, that truly is this disruption and the continuity of the joint is disrupted like that. You really got to be concerned about what is the long-term healing prospects in that alignment, which is
not desirable. So what's your experience with that? So... let's say I have a patient that goes into that forced dorsiflexion, forced eversion, right? I really put some stress on that deltoid ligament, that elusive deltoid ligament, right?
Right.
And, I do the Cleaver test or the Cliver test, depending on what part of the country you came from. And I, I'm treating and I'm training kind of conservatively. And maybe I put it, I refer to you, I put them in a walking boot.
Right.
And we're going to watch, and we're going to watch, and we're going to watch. At some point, we got to be able to say, this is a surgical intervention or it's not.
That's right. And I think that's sometimes a tough call. Usually you get these folks that 2 to 4 week period of not seeing a progression is pretty helpful to know. You kind of know within a month they're just not getting better.
The key
is knowing what the progression has been or lack of or what it is, because some of these folks, I really will knowing how the potential ramifications of missing it or not knowing how severe it is early will really protect them to get them to a stage that then I can test them out functionally and know where they are, and you have a better feel. But it's usually about a month.
Now let me go back to something on a clinical exam, right? So if I go down my anatomy, I've got that medial malleolus, and then obviously I've got the talus, and I go just a little bit medial, and I've got the navicular. On a clinical exam, somebody that's just coming out of school,
right,
they may say that they may see the drop in the navicular, and they may say, "Oh, that's really
right.
That's a pronated talus. It may not be a pronated talus." So,
yeah,
walk us through that a little bit.
So sometimes, even knowing, really, clinical exam as far as palpation is difficult because things are so close in proximity that sometimes you get a misread on what that really is. I think, you know, it's putting it all together as far as knowing some of this diagnostic imaging that's helpful, knowing an exam, knowing the progression, a repeat exam. I mean, those are things that really put it all together. It's hard to know. With the deltoid ligaments, interesting enough, they do extremely well, even with severe injuries.
It's a strong complex.
It is. And so what happens is it's also got the potential for healing because of all the surface area.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all this other potential area to come together. So what happens is, you know, very commonly we'll have patients with a lateral malleolus ankle fracture that we'll fix. Concerned about what the deltoids, we know there's this lateral translation that we can see the talus shifting and the deltoid being injured. And they do great.
Mm-hmm.
And we never touch, open, even think about fixing the deltoid because, historically, we have not been able to make a difference in that. We haven't made it better. It's kind of been what it is. And it is interesting enough, some of those folks are they have more pain from that for an extended period of time than they do from the fracture.
Right.
After the fixation. So it's something to make people aware of, counsel, understand it will get better. It just takes time. But those are not as, we're not as aggressive with management. That just given the history has been that they do well, conservatively.
That's great. I don't have a whole lot of other questions, you know.
I'm sorry, no either.
Good. Let's go to the lateral side.
Okay.
So, you know, I've got the trifecta, right? I've got the anterior tibial or talofibular,
mm-hmm.
calcaneofibular, posterior mm-hmm. talofibular. All right, anterior talofibular, 95% of all ankle sprains.
Yeah, it's bad.
Yeah.
It's very common.
Anterior talofibular.
Very wimpy.
Straight anterior drawer, right? And it's just, if I look in my mind, you know, I've got this tiny little, it almost looks like a piece, like a towel. Small towel. It connects, you know, from fibula to talus.
Right.
Anterior drawer, I pull it forward. You know, it's just loose. Okay. I can also do the talo tilt.
Mm-hmm.
I can also use talo tilt for eversion.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Right.
So tell us about grade two, you know, from a clinical standpoint, you know, patient presents and it's, you know, I went in that traditional kind of plantar flexion, internal rotation, supination. You know, I got this part. You take your 10-pound thumb, you press right where that ligament is,
right.
Jumps off the table. You already know what it is.
Right.
So walk us through between progression of, you know, ATF to CF. And then when does that posterior involvement start to happen? What should we look for?
Exactly. It's more with the, you know, all of them kind of start in a similar mechanism. And then it's the completion of that mechanism or how far it goes.
Okay.
And so usually there's more of a rotatory component to it that can be more significant to develop the injury that continues all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
The direct, you know, inversion is really how you injured your calcaneofibular ligament.
Right. No real supination.
Not necessarily.
It's just a straight.
It's fairly loose in a plantar flexed kind of supinate position. So usually you have to have a significant eversion as well, mm-hmm. Inversion as well. And then that rotation that comes with from the supination zone is what finishes off the posterior.
Right.
So then those can even come, you know, full circle. And we're talking about how much it disrupts the deltoid ligament.
Really?
Yes.
So, because of that extreme supination and inversion, right, it kind of pinches that medial malleolus. And now
that's
you
right.
Start
so
to
now you start getting that. So it is interesting, the progression, and it's just hard to, you know, seeing it, sometimes you've got to say, oh, man, this is going to go a certain way. It really just depends on how you know, people react to that as far as when it happens. I think the key is, it's like grading them because obviously, you know, a type 2 or even a type 3 anterior talofibular ligament is are going to do much for that. You really
right.
don't have to.
Right.
Even though it's going to be severe grading, but actually not a very bad angle sprain.
Right. I mean, you're going to see some capsular swelling. You're going to see,
right.
your basic effusion and maybe some edema, some exudate, but with some elevation, icing, compression.
They do extremely well.
A couple
well.
Anti-inflammatories.
So you get a combination of significant, and to get a significant, usually, calcaneofibular ligament injury,
mm-hmm.
there's some component of the talo just because of just the location wise. And so in the translation, so there's enough translation using the talus to develop that injury that you get an anterotalofibular ligament as well. And that combination of what can be bad.
Okay.
That definitely you will end up seeing these folks that truly, you know, just with some gravity have a little bit of a talar tilt.
Mm-hmm.
And you know an exam, they literally, you can just kind of keep coming.
Yeah.
And
it's
really
like that torn ACL.
It's right. You know,
it's just,
it
I can,
really
I can
does,
move that tibia from here to Ohio.
That's right.
Right.
It keeps coming and even, you know, some are even the you know, talking about looking at these where you can see the deltoid is still intact and you'll see a pivoting.
Really?
Where you can almost grab the whole hind foot and pivot around the deltoid.
Really?
Yeah. So it's a severe enough injury.
Sorry.
That if you can, wow. You can, you know, get the nuances of that on exam, it's pretty significant. And so the key is usually identifying that enough to know, okay, these are the folks that we need to be very aggressive with, you know, conservatively, mm-hmm. To know that they're not going to develop a chronic issue.
Right.
And then, or a re-injury, at least in the early phase of the appropriate management.
Okay, so now let's go back to, right, we got the ATF, we got the CF. Let's go to the posterior tail for ligament.
Okay.
Right, and I'm assuming that is, again, you know, going back to, you know, not necessarily the it's just straight inversion, really.
Yeah, so exactly.
And
so
you said the completion, right? Yeah, going so around the clock.
So if you can imagine both the cantilever ligament as well as the posterior tail ligament, because of the location mm-hmm. and where they attach on the heel more posteriorly, mm-hmm. it's a dorsiflexion actually puts them in more stress.
So if I have a dorsiflex situation, an inversion. So if I have a forced dorsiflexion
and an inversion,
I'm going to go CF PTF.
Yeah.
And if I have forced dorsiflex and eversion, I got deltoid. So really, plantar flexion is really that anterior talus.
That's right. And you think about it, the benefit of the plantar flex position, or at least the benefit, at least from an injury standpoint, is there's some laxity based on the structure of the talus, you know, being wider anteriorly than posteriorly. When the anterior portion is not engaged,
right.
there's a lot more play and laxity right. in the sense that you can easily injure your ligament,
right.
but as far as local damage, it's not that significant.
So it's really interesting from an athletic training standpoint, right, where we're going to go tape an ankle. What are we always taught? We're always taught, you know, put them in the dorsiflexion, kind of close the
right, exactly.
Close
that
the talus.
Stable position.
Right, close the talus in there and tape them in that situation.
That's right.
All right, let's go to, you know, in my history of practicing, I've seen all these sprains that you're talking about, all the injuries. I've never seen a posterior tibiofibular.
Right.
Ligament. Yes. How does that happen?
You know, I don't think you can get it in an isolated way. I mean, I think that's it's more of a true structure that we can identify, you know, anatomically and say, hey, this isn't the constellation of ligaments that we've got in this zone and how they're injured. I mean, they do all sorts of interesting studies looking at the strength of it as they fractionally release them and do that kind of study, but I think as a unit is most isolated.
And so let's just say, hypothetically, I release the posterior tibiofibula. What happens?
Probably not much.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, honestly, really, it's and these work in concert in certain positions. I mean, you may be able to.
I'm thinking like all the posterior musculature that's back there.
That's right. I mean, it's well protected. There's
yeah,
no
I mean,
question.
You've got at least the soleus, right? If I depending on where you came out, you know, you got your anatomy, right? If I think of tricep surae, I've got, you know, plantaris, soleus, gastrocnemius. If I go kind of out of that European tricep surae, then I've got mm-hmm. soleus and gastrocnemius and, you know, I think only 35% of the people have got a plantaris or something
right.
like that.
Exactly.
And the best way to identify is that whether you've got a palmaris longus. Is that right? Is that a true?
I don't know. I don't remember exactly if that's indicative of that. But
it's one of those tertiary muscles.
Yeah. I got one.
It's like the peroneus tertius. I mean, it's
right. Yeah.
You don't really need
specific.
Yeah. You don't really need
right.
it. Okay. So when I think about that posterior aspect of the tibia, I've got those big, you know, plantar flexors that are back there that are really providing a lot of
that's right.
Right. And I've got some retinaculums around there and some fascia.
I think the idea is if you think about it, I mean, although it resists force in a dorsiflex position, I think there's so much other stability created in that position that your chance of injuring it are almost impossible.
Small
I mean, you're going to end up doing something else significant, and that's going to be irrelevant as far as how significant that injury is.
All right, so now let's kind of go back to – let's keep on working posteriorly. Tell me about ruptured Achilles tendon.
Okay.
All right. So I was taught in school, right, you've got that musculotendinous junction down the osteotendinous junction. Somewhere between the ages of 40 to 50, that osteotendinous junction starts to change from a biomechanical standpoint, right, and they put on that kind of forced – it's a forced – I guess a forced dorsiflexion, right? And they feel like something kicked them in the back.
Yeah,
of the leg.
So it's the eccentric load
right.
that's significant. So you're both contracting the muscle at the same time as elongating.
Right.
And that's a significant increased force on that structure. And so, yes, what is the big deal? It is significantly an issue in those who are the 40 to 50-year-old
males. Yeah, why?
It's an anatomic, you know,
it's an anomaly.
Developmental
yeah.
issue as far as aging, I think, that puts you at risk. And And yes, they said the same thing. They wanted to hoop hit him with the bat.
Felt like somebody kicked me in the back of the leg.
I mean, and Kobe Bryant said the same thing. I forgot who was guarding him when he ruptured his. He turned around and asked him why he kicked him. The guy looked at him like, what are you talking about? You just fell down.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so it's very common as far as the way it feels.
And it's more common to rupture, you know, in school, right? You learn about these different avulsion fractures. Mm-hmm. And so when Achilles ruptures like that, it's going to take a piece of that periosteum off with it?
No, typically it's a little more proximal. Yeah. So most of these are happening in the true tendinous portion. Mm-hmm. Is there, some people prone to this as far as having some degree of degeneration or unhealthy tendon in that zone? I think it's probably true. We do see some folks who have what we would term a prodromal syndrome of something. They'll say, my ankle was hurting for the last 3 weeks, and then I went and played basketball, and the thing snapped.
And I had this force eccentric load.
Yeah, and then they'll say that. They'll finally say, it's almost like I could tell something was going to happen. It just wasn't feeling right.
Yeah.
Now, they didn't expect that, but it's pretty significant that someone will tell you those stories. So.
And then, once that calcaneus or once that Achilles tendon ruptures, mm-hmm. Did we just lose power?
Yeah.
Are we still on here?
Yeah.
Okay, great. just from my own knowledge, if once that Achilles tendon rupture happens, I've got tibialis posterior back there. Mm-hmm. I've got what else is back? That's about it.
Yeah. So you got your other flexors for the
right.
Yeah, for
your flexors. They can't go in. They can't essentially. They're bipedal mammals, so now you can't.
Well, this is what happens. So no question. I mean, your Achilles is basically a very controlling stabilizer muscle complex. Most of your plantar flexion as far as push off is really your posterior tibialis. So these people, some people think something's wrong, they can still ambulate, some can't. It's interesting how they do. I think it's important to restore that normal function as how those interact, because it's very dangerous to not have that protective decelerating position that the Achilles provides. But it is interesting to see how some people do okay without it, but definitely not athletically.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go Achilles tendon deficient.
No, it's very hard. I mean, very few folks do we allow that to happen.
And what's the situation? I'm assuming geriatric population.
Yeah, that would be it. I mean, I think we do have some folks who may not be best candidates for surgical treatment and can treat conservatively. There's some that really are proponents of that management. I think the key is treating them appropriately in that fashion, where you have to get the some degree of apposition of the tissue to get proper healing.
Okay.
And have the mechanical advantage. The problem with that is just how do you do that? So typically it's serial casting, deep plantar flexion, then you bring them up serially with casting. It does work. Those folks are a little higher risk for re-rupture because of the scar tissue that becomes interposed in there. And you usually have a little bit of less power for push-off. But some of them, you'd be hard-pressed to say, hey, you didn't have this great repair, right? Because they didn't, and they do fine. So.
All right, so now let's move anterior a little bit. You have some people that are listening to this broadcast that either are a lot like Jasmine, whether they're just coming out of, she's in her third year at Texas A&M. Mm-hmm. So we have this, vast array of people listening. Let's move forward now. Let's talk about a Lisfranc fracture.
Okay.
So what's a Lisfranc fracture?
Lisfranc fracture is usually some version of an injury that happens involving the Lisfranc ligament.
And which is what?
The Lisfranc ligament moves basically from the medial cuneiform bone in the midfoot, traverses towards the base of the second metatarsal. Mm-hmm. And what that provides is what we call the Roman arch of the foot. So it is the actually not longitudinal arch support, but it's the cross-sectional kind of side-to-side, so medial lateral support. And it's critical, really, attaching the first ray to the rest of the foot.
Uh-huh. And the first ray for those is also the great toe.
Yes, sir. So the great toe side of the foot.
Right.
And we call that the ray, meaning all the way up. So from the actual toe through the metatarsal into the midfoot zone. And it's really critical for maintaining that Roman arch that we talk about, and how these medial to lateral bones are kind of stacked in the Roman arch. And so when that ligament is disrupted or injured, very commonly it'll actually it's strong enough and thick enough that it'll actually pull off a fragment of bone.
An avulsion
fracture that we would term, you know, a loose frank fracture.
And so how does somebody happen, right? I remember in graduate school, it was the first time I had seen a loose frank fracture. I thought, oh, that's really interesting. I don't even know what that is. We had a foot and ankle specialist say, this is what it is. So what happens? How does somebody get a loose frank fracture?
Well, usually it is a loaded plantar flex foot.
Okay.
So, and so we see this very commonly, linemen, people stepping off a large step onto their forefoot, and basically kind of the crumpling phenomenon of having so much force quickly generated on the midfoot that's not ready for that.
So you say forced plantar flexion, just to give everybody that's listening a visual, what does that look like?
Yeah, so kind of pointing your toes and stepping very hard onto your forefoot.
Right, and all that force being translated into forefoot.
That's right. So sometimes it's enough of your own body weight to be enough if it's transmitted the right way. And we see it a lot of times in linemen or other, or people injured when someone else steps in the back of their foot
right.
with their foot in that position.
Right, and that's a you know, if I think of it correctly, right, now you're in the truly forced
plantar flexion. Yes, that truly is a forced plantar flexion.
And so if I kind of move up a little bit, just to give everybody, so we've talked about loose frank Achilles tendon, all the ligaments of the ankle, essentially what we see clinically. Let's move up to this grand term of what we call shin splints.
Mm-hmm.
Right, shin splints, in my definition, is a catch-all term to anything that happens in the lower, shank,
right.
Essentially.
Yeah. Right.
And tell us what you think.
Yeah, so, typically it does come a little bit different. I mean, it is kind of a catch-all terminology. Most of what we see is either some version of what we call periosteitis, mm-hmm. where these folks develop the periosteum becoming very inflamed in that anterior distal third medial aspect of their shin.
Mm-hmm. On the tibial side.
On the tibia, right. So that happens commonly, it truly being a inflammation of the covering of the bone.
Mm-hmm.
In others, it's more of a irritation as the muscular, the flexors
mm-hmm.
Of the foot, actually the muscles come off of that zone
mm-hmm.
And the bone. And so and depending on how you figure out which is it the muscular pulling that's causing the inflammatory process? Is it just something happening in the muscle? It's debated, but that's the area.
So a lot of people, they point to shin splints, really, that kind of term. They're really kind of pressing on that tibialis anterior. But they're not. It's not really the tibialis anterior. It's
no,
the posterior muscular, or it's the periosteum.
Yeah, exactly. So most of the time, it's just posterior to that ridge that really gets you more into the posterior muscles. And sometimes, it's a little more anterior just because of the way the tibia is so accessible
mm-hmm.
To find anteriorly, and you can push there. And if you push your shin right now, I mean, that's a tender hurt regardless. I mean,
yeah.
With my normal shin,
yeah, if you push your shin against the couch,
that's uncomfortable, right? So I think it's highly sensitive.
Yeah.
So I think some people maybe are more sensitive than others, and that would develop it and say they have it, and you'd say, oh, it's no big deal, I'm fine. So, but it does happen, and people get enough of irritation that prevents them from being able to be athletic and active.
I want to stay on the talocrural joint just for a second, okay? And let's go into, I remember when I first saw the abbreviation, I thought the ankles got obsessive compulsive disorder. And then I thought it was the organized crime division, and it's
right,
not
exactly.
Either of those. It's osteochondritis desiccans. So
right.
Explain to us a little bit how, this joint mice happens.
Yeah, so some folks, just either genetically or congenitally or whatever you would want to term it, have a area of their talus. That it, at the level of the ankle that develops this lack of full normal bony structure. And what happens is in those areas, it's almost like a pocket beneath the cartilage cap that's covering the talus. And so structurally, it is not sound. And so very commonly, these folks will not have any problems for years and then eventually develop enough of either erosion or irritation or something to that zone and develop a tear of that cartilage. Because it's kind of like a trap door, it just kind of falls into the space. Or in some ways that the bone that's involved that's not healthy becomes dislodged with a piece of a fragment of the cartilage, and then you can get joint mice and different things.
Yeah, and I remember when I was a graduate student, I took one of the athletes over and we took a picture of it and said, oh, we put it up and said, you got some joint mice. Right. And he looked at me and he says, man, I got a mouse in my ankle. And I said, no, no.
Exactly.
Is,
right.
And why do they call it joint mice?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure I know.
You don't know. You just know it is.
And that is what, you know, commonly referred to as joint mice.
Yeah. And we also see it in the elbow.
We see it other places too. It's not uncommon. You know, our body and definitely the joints tends to almost act as a pearl sometimes, that you'll have an irritation of some sort that is kind of like the seed that will then become calcified in this buildup and develop into more of the joint mass situation. So you see that sometimes as these calcifications.
So if I move up just a little bit, right, we talked about shin splints and we kind of go up and down here a little bit. Tell us just real briefly, and then I think I know you're busy, you gotta get going here, but tell us real briefly about the difference between acute and I guess it would be chronic, and the term just escapes me now, but that compartment syndrome. You know, when I was in school, I learned, hey, look, you can get kicked, and you've got this acute chronic compartment syndrome. And then you've got this chronic, where it's kind of like the shin splint, those capsules are, you know, collapsing
right.
on the
So, leg. Yeah, so the difference in those, I mean, obviously, with an acute compartment syndrome, we see that mostly with an injury or something that would give you this all of a sudden dramatic change in either the you know, swelling in a confined compartment. And we talk about these compartments, what we're terming that is really these muscles that are trapped beneath the fascial covering that divides them into different compartments. And so if there's enough swelling or you know, increased pressure that develops because of that swelling within those compartments, you can develop damage to the actual muscle and be permanent. So acutely, that's important, and you know, tibia fractures, things that have a lot of trauma can be concerning. Otherwise, for the chronic versions that people develop, it's more exertional compartment syndrome is what we would term that. And so those folks are developing increased swelling by using those muscles with running different activities, and they'll present with just leg pain. I mean,
right.
And it's a transient phenomenon that will happen. They're fine with the activity. Then they wait, and 20 minutes later, after they're finished running, their leg is really hurting severely, and then it dissipates over, you know, the next hour or so.
And anybody that is familiar with that lower leg anatomy, right, we always go back to the Tom, Dick, and Very Nervous Harry.
Right.
Right. Jasmine, have you learned about that? Tibialis posterior, flexor digitorum longus, tibular artery, tibial vein. Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.